woman's worth. When I told girlfriends I was writing a book about women, most of them said something like this. For us? For women who have been to hell and back? How strange that this should be the club we belong to. Women who have been to hell and back. But we all understand what this means. It's a membership badge we wear with knowing looks and lines on our forehead. Most of us have known at least one divorce or one devastating breakup, whether we were married or not. Other circumstances can get us into the club as well. Abortion, disease, a variety of public or private humiliations, drugs, alcohol, the death of a loved one, incompetent parents, sick children. It's everything we thought life would never be. We don't feel self-pity so much as fear and deep grief. Such has been our woman quest. It is conscious and disciplined, or unconscious and unbridled. Whether we've learned anything or not, our suffering has shaped who we are, and for better or for worse, we've been changed by our last few years. We are not who we would have been had we not descended. We have a lot of stories. We have a lot to edit. In writing this book, I have no purpose other than a creative spill of my own guts, but that in itself is a passionate purpose, and I have seen how like my guts are to those of other women. The relationships, careers, children, dreams, betrayals, hopes, wins, losses, all these form my landscape too. Our feelings have blended. Our stories converge. Every writer hopes his or her words will create a door, a passage of light the reader can travel through. I dream that dream for this book. It's very difficult being a woman. It's difficult being a man, too, I realize, but this is a book about women. Sam Keen wrote a book about men, which he called Fire in the Belly. My friend Tara called me up one day and told me she wanted to write a companion volume, Volcano in the Uterus. I laughed when she said that, but inside I was thinking, oh, and catastrophes in the breasts and terror in the ovaries. More women cry, loudly or silently, every fraction of every moment in every town of every country than anyone, man or woman, realizes. We cry for our children, our lovers, our parents, and ourselves. We cry in shame because we feel no right to cry, and we cry in peace because we feel it's time we did cry. We cry for the world, yet we think we cry alone. We feel that no one hears, that there is no listening that matters, and we must all listen now. We must hold the crying woman's hand and minister to her tenderly, or she will turn this collective feminine shadow self into a monster who will go unheard no longer. This book is an effort to hear and understand her in today's world as she exists at this moment, imprisoned while still dressed in all her ancient soiled regalia. She's like a child, yet she's not a child. She's our mother, our sister, our daughter, our lover. She needs us now, and we need her. Womanhood today is tentative and unsure, a thing defined more by what it isn't than by what it is. For some women, this is not a problem. They've risen above the complexities of society's projections and misunderstandings, and now fly high above the clouds. For most women, however, the resistances they encountered as they reached for the sky were so great that their wings have now drooped, and they try no longer. Womanhood is a mass pain of unspoken depth, and when we try to speak it, we're liable to be told, there you go, complaining again. As long as this is true, not half but all of humanity is obstructed in its journey to our cosmic destination. This destination is far, far away, a place so deep inside us that we have barely glimpsed its outer walls. This is a tape about a woman's inner life. Here we are our real selves, while in the outer world we are imposters. We're not sure why we're posing, except we have no clue how not to. We have forgotten the part we came here to play. We've lost the key to our own house. We're hanging out outside the door. The stress of being so long away from home is hurting us, even killing us. We must not stay away. We must find the key. For until we do, we will continue to shrivel. Our faces, our breasts, our ovaries, our stories. We're drooping over and falling apart. If we knew how to moan, they would hear us on the moon. But the dirt around us is moving, making room for tiny sprouts. Like every woman, I know what I know. Something is starting to happen. New things lie in store for the earth, and one of them is us. Womanhood is being recast, and we are pregnant en masse, giving birth to our own redemption. Watch. Wait. Time will unfold and fulfill its purpose. While we wait, we must not go unconscious. We must think and grow. Rejoice and dream, kneel and pray. There is holiness in the air today. We are giving birth to goddesses. They are who we are, for they are us. Friends, therapists, artists, businesswomen, teachers, healers, mothers. Start laughing, girls. We have a new calling. You can tell who we are. We use whatever our business is as a front for talking about things that really matter. We're only stuck in this work, you see, because our real work was taken away from us several thousand years ago. We looked on the map, but our town was gone. We looked through the catalog, but couldn't find the course we wanted. It's as if someone removed our chair, but couldn't take away our longing to sit. What, you say, me, a goddess? Yes, I say, and don't act so surprised. You knew when you were little you were born for something special, and no matter what happened to you, that couldn't be erased. The magic could not be drained from your heart any more than Lady Macbeth could wash the guilt from her hands. Sorry to tell you, but you had it right years ago, and then you forgot. You were born with a mystical purpose, and listening to this now, you might remember what it is. Together, we embark on a quest for our own enchantment. It will take us to a place where what is feminine is sacred, as are a lot of other things as well. There we can become who we are meant to be and live the life we are meant to live. But we need to see the lay of the land, and we need to see clearly the way back home. There are women who are enchanted, living here now as there have always been and always will be. They are bearers of the goddess's torch, however dim its light may shine. On the inner plains they are priestesses and queens. They are absolutely powerful. They have made it past the gates. I have known a few, and I have heard of others, and I will tell you all I know of who they are and how they do it. At every moment, a woman makes a choice between the state of the queen and the state of the slave girl. In our natural state, we are glorious beings. In the world of illusion, we are lost and imprisoned, slaves to our appetites and our will to false power. Our jailer is a three-headed monster. One head is our past, one head our insecurity, and one our popular culture. Our past is a story existing only in our minds. Look, analyze, understand, and forgive. Then, as quickly as possible, chuck it. Our insecurity is inevitable in the absence of personal meaning. Without a sense of connection to deeper, more noble ideas, we are doomed to a desperate struggle for things that fill us up. The job, the relationship, the looks, the body. We're tyrannized by a belief that we are inadequate. No Nazi with machine gun could be a more tormenting presence. The monster's third head is the pop culture we collectively spend millions of dollars supporting each year. It does not support us in return. Most movies do not love us, most advertising does not love us, most of the fashion industry does not love us, and most rock and roll does not love us. That one's very sad because it used to. Like many battered wives, we look endlessly for love in places that have no capacity to love us back. We must consciously choose to do this no longer. Until we do, the monster will keep us locked up in his dungeon. Deep inside us, however, is an inborn escape hatch. It's a love that doesn't end or waver, or make money off us, or play games with us, or stomp on our hearts. It's our spiritual core. Within this realm, we exist as cosmic royals, mothers, sisters, daughters of the sun and moon and stars. Within it, we find God, the goddess, and our own sweet selves. Laugh at all of this at your emotional peril. The outside world contains many vicious dreams, and these dreams have a hold on us. I know, I know. But I have heard some spiritual secrets, and so have you if your ears have been open. There are ways to transcend, ways to go forward. We can leave the monster behind. We can find deliverance for our hearts and come home to scented roses. There is a door, a true one, a passage of emotional opportunity, and we are perfectly capable of sailing through it. Angels are holding it open for all of us to enter. But you must be bold. Sissies can't see angels, so sissies can't find the door. Most women I know are priestesses and healers, although many don't yet know it, and some never will. We are all of us sisters of a mysterious order. Several years ago, I found myself waking up at 4:15 each morning, my eyes popping open as if on cue. Later, I learned that in days of old, 4:15 was considered the witching hour. How perfect that seemed to me. We would all awaken at the same time and join with one another and worship and know. We still know things. As best as we can, we continue to commune. Is the baby asleep? Did you get the job? Did he come home? Does your pain feel better? Have you heard the news? We begin as friends and then develop a shared realization, conscious or unconscious, that we are bearers of magic and that our circles of support are circles of mystical power. It's a woman's prerogative to know of magic and practice magic and use her knowledge to help the world. We're used to thinking of Friday the 13th as bad luck. In fact, Friday the 13th was the day the witches gathered. When the patriarchal system, headed by the early church, began to squelch the power of women, witches were deemed evil, and many great women were deemed witches. Their meeting time, then, was seen as bad luck rather than what it truly was, a time for women to gather and share energy and pray together and heal. Well, our mystical power should not be relegated to the distant past. It still exists. I want mine now, and so does every woman I know. Our power is not evil, but good. We must reclaim our goodness as well as our power. Today, the reason we haven't found our grail, the key to who we are as women, is because we look for it in worlds of false power, the very worlds that took it away from us in the first place. Neither men nor work can restore our lost scepter. Nothing in the world can take us home. Only the radar in our hearts can do that, and when it does, we return to our castles. There we are crowned in gold, and we remember how to laugh, how to love, how to rule. We can't look to the world to restore our worth. We're here to restore our worth to the world. The world outside us can reflect our glory, but it cannot create it. It cannot crown us. Only God can crown us, and He already has. I once saw a funny birthday card. On the front it read, "Happy birthday to my daughter, the princess." And on the inside it continued, "From your mother, the queen." So what is a princess? And what is a queen? Why is princess often a pejorative description of a certain type of woman, and the word queen hardly ever applied to women at all? A princess is a girl who knows that she will get there, who is on her way perhaps, but is not there yet. She has power, but she does not yet wield it responsibly. She is indulgent and frivolous. She cries, but not yet noble tears. She stomps her feet and does not know how to contain her pain or use it creatively. A queen, on the other hand, is wise. She has earned her serenity, not having had it bestowed on her, but having passed her tests. She has suffered and grown more beautiful because of it. She has proved she can hold her kingdom together. She has become its vision. She cares deeply about something bigger than herself. She rules with authentic power. Our kingdom is our life, and our life is our kingdom. We are all meant to rule from a glorious place. When God is on the throne, then so are we. When God is in exile, our lands are at war and our kingdoms are in chaos. To be a princess is to play at life. To be a queen is to be a serious player. Audrey Hepburn was a queen. Barbara Jordan is a queen. Gloria Steinem is a queen. Most of us are a little of both. The purpose of life as a woman is to ascend to the throne and rule with heart. The growth of a girl into a woman, a princess into a queen, is not a liberal transition. Like any true creative flow, it is radical. That is not to say it is angry or harsh, but it is radical, the way truth is radical, and birth and art and real love and death. It changes things. It represents a shift in core beliefs, a belly up of dominant paradigms. Without this shift, a woman seesaws between the brink of disaster and the brink of salvation. She goes from moments of bliss to moments of terror, and then the children and the world begin to seesaw with her. When a woman has owned her passionate nature, allowing love to flood her heart, her thoughts grow wild and fierce and beautiful. Her juices flow, her heart expands. She has thrown off crutch and compromise. She has glimpsed the enchanted kingdom, the vast and magical realms of the goddess within her. Here all things are transformed. And there is a purpose to this, that the world might be mothered back to a great and glorious state. When a woman conceives her true self, a miracle occurs and life around her begins again. Mary's was a virgin birth, and the word virgin means a woman unto herself. The actualized woman is powerful unto herself and gives birth to things divine. Today we have the chance to give birth to a healed and transformed world. This cannot be done without a major uprising of the glorious in women, because nothing can be healed without the female powers that nurture and protect, intuit and endure. What does this mean for the individual woman living day to day in a world that resists her expansion and makes her wrong for her passions? It means finding others who have seen the same light. They are everywhere, and like us, they await instruction. They are men and women, young and old, who have heard the joke but take it too seriously to laugh. It is funny, but also tragic, this cutting off at the pass of the life force of half of humanity. Something new is now brewing, and let's be grateful that it is. The Queen is coming to reclaim her girls. Every woman I know wants to be a glorious queen, but that option was hardly on the multiple choice questionnaire we were handed when we were little girls. Rarely did anyone tell us we could choose to be magic. When I was a child, there was a woman who lived across the street named Betty Lynn. She was sort of a cross between Auntie Mame and Jane Mansfield. I thought she was the most beautiful, most fascinating, most wonderful woman in the world. Betty Lynn was wild and gorgeous, and she drove a Cadillac. I thought it was beige, but she called it the color of champagne. She wanted a thatched roof on her guest house. She obviously had sex with her husband, and she always told me I was wonderful. Years later, I remembered the scotch and water that was almost always in her hand, and many things began to make sense that hadn't made sense when I was young. But at the time, she was a model of sorts, a glamorous woman who made me see magic, when all I found on my side of the street was a lid placed on my emotions and disapproval of my more outrageous passions. Now, why, in the 30-odd years since I knew this woman, have I never forgotten her? What did she represent that struck me as so real, so passionate, so enchanted? Whatever it was, the alcohol helped her let it out. But then the alcohol enslaved her, and then it killed her. That's clear. But why do people who have the most ardor, the most enchantment, the most power so often feel the need for drugs and alcohol? They do not drink just to dull their pain. They drink to dull their ecstasy. Betty Lynn lived in a world that doesn't know from ecstatic women or want to know or even allow them to exist. In former times, she would have had her own temple, and people from all around the world would have gathered to sit at her feet and hear her pronounce the marvelous. She would have mixed herbs and oils. But an unenlightened world began to burn those women, and the world burns them still. Betty Lynn crucified herself before anyone else had a chance to, and many of us are a little like her, choosing to implode rather than take on society's punishment, and those of us who don't must bear society's wrath. But we lived through it, bruised and battered though we might be. And more of us are now living to tell the tale, surviving the fire, surviving sober, and hopefully altered in such a way that our daughters will have an easier time. We have a job to do, reclaiming our glory. So what if we're called grandiose? So what if we're accused of being in dangerous denial of our faults, our neuroses, our weaknesses? It's an ancient trick, this, telling a woman that her glory is her sickness. You bet we're in denial. We deny the power of weakness to hold us back, be it the weakness of the world or the weakness in our own past. We're on to better things, such as owning our beauty and honoring the courage it has taken us to get here and claiming our natural power to heal and be healed. We're not grandiose, but we're tired. Tired of pretending we're guilty when we know we're innocent, that we're plain when we know we're beautiful, and that we're weak when we know we're strong. For far too long, we have forgotten we are cosmic royals. Our mothers forgot, and their mothers before them. We regret their tears. We mourn their sadness. But now, at last, we break the chain. When the goddess is ready to reemerge, she reemerges. There is no person or law or institution that can hold her back. Like the energy of Christ, of which she is part, the goddess finds her way into the hearts and minds of millions of individual women, and they change. It doesn't matter who doesn't change when enough people do. This is true in any social, political, or cultural tide. When an idea reaches critical mass, there is no stopping the shift its presence will induce. One of the most sophisticated, insidious conspiracies has been perpetrated against women. Thousands of years of history have been largely rewritten in order to erase from collective memory the fact that men were not always on top. Archaeological evidence now argues for the existence of a 20,000-year period of history when men and women lived as equals, with neither sex dominating the other. The earth flourished. The so-called feminine values of compassion, nurturing, and nonviolence were shared by men and women alike and were the most vital elements of social structure. Women were revered as priestesses and healers. Our intuitive strengths were not scorned, but respected. Our more fluid modes of thought and feeling were seen as creative rhythms, not flaky girl stuff. To our mates and lovers, our children and friends, we were natural priestesses. We healed one another through our compassionate connection to spirit and earth. But we took a detour, and the goddess was masked. The world is currently set up according to masculine models of thought and structure, and it has been for thousands of years. Aggression, force, domination, and control have been at the heart of our social agreements. Organization, technology, rational analysis have been the order of this very long day. Now, during this time, the feminine principles of nonviolence and surrender and the values of intuition and nurturing and healing were pushed aside. We forgot the power of a tender touch. Slowly, but surely, generation after generation, over thousands of years, the feminine was made to seem ridiculous. She was debased in men as well as in women, all of us risking shame and choosing to relate to her. We could know her in bed, and she was good with children, but other than that, she did not belong here. She wasn't silenced, just invalidated. She could still speak, but she wouldn't be heard. Note the Statue of Liberty and Emma Lazarus' poem inscribed at its base. Give me your tired, your poor, Liberty says, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. Her manifesto of concern for human life became a cornerstone of compassionate strength at the center of American consciousness. But our national mind, dissociated from its feminine nature, has sought domination and control instead of sharing and nurturing. Our words began to change, from give me your tired to tell them to go home. We kept the statue, but we no longer take her seriously. During the 1986 centennial celebration in New York Harbor, I was struck by the irony of the spectacular party thrown at the Statue of Liberty. A government that had systematically dismantled the elements of the social and political policy that formed the lifeblood of Emma Lazarus's poem now hosted a lavish celebration at Liberty's feet. We treat her the way we have treated all women during the times when the goddess is silenced. We dress her up, we show her off, but we don't want to listen to what she has to say. And no one will listen to us until we listen ourselves. The goddess awakens in our hearts before she awakens in the world. We must notice that she exists. We must honor and worship and revere her, regardless of the name by which we call her, for not to do so is to dishonor ourselves. She is our feminine essence. She is the female power and the spiritual glory that lies within every woman and also every man. Forget looking for earthly role models because there aren't many, and even when we find them, they live their own lives and not ours. We must look instead inside ourselves. The goddess doesn't enter us from outside. She emerges from deep within. She's not held back by what happened to us in the past. She is conceived in consciousness, born in love and nurtured by higher thinking. She is integrity and value, created and sustained by the hard work of personal growth and the discipline of a life lived actively in hope. Build community. Nurture those less fortunate. Become yourself. Seek God. No less potent steps than these will be deep enough to move you forward. The crucifixion of the goddess, the invalidation of feminine beliefs and values, lies at the heart of all our painful dramas. But crucifixion is merely a prelude to resurrection, and we are now living at the beginning stages of the resurrection of the goddess. This occurs not through the reemergence of any one particular symbol, be it Mary, Kuan Yin, Gaia, or Isis. She has many names and faces, but her most important one is your own. Her reemergence now is a cellular upheaval, arising up from the depths of individual women throughout the world. It is a new spirit, a new strength, new conviction, and new care. The most glorious angels light up the sky when the Queen of Heaven returns to her throne. These are archetypal images that trace for us the trail of the feminine journey, its purpose and direction. Women must remember how important it is to honor women. In reforming the Christian church, Martin Luther chose to throw out Mary. In rediscovering the church within us, we choose to bring her back. A powerful tool for the reclamation of our glorious feminine identity is the worship of feminine gods. As the mother of the Son of God, the Virgin Mary gave human birth to God's expression on earth. Without her body and her nurturing, the Word would have remained just a Word. Through her womb and her maternal compassion, she became the vehicle through which the Word was made flesh. Now, Mary is real. She's a symbol, but she's also much more than that. She's an energy, an essential hierarchical truth or being that is the essence of all women. She's found in many religions. Some call her the goddess. She's active psychically, participating alchemically in the areas of our suffering and our liberation. For millions of people, she's no joke. At her birth, her parents knew her life was to be used in the service of a great and holy cause. She was raised to be a channel of light, which is to say she was guided in the direction of her highest human qualities. She was entrusted by God with a profound and mighty task on earth, and over the years, her body, soul, and mind were prepared for that service. Now, to think of ourselves in terms of Mary's purpose and ministry is to heal our wounds. It is to fill our minds with the light that casts out the darkness of myriad neuroses. In every area of our experience as women, we're lost and disconnected because we do not perceive ourselves in spiritual terms. We think of ourselves as flesh and bone, resumes, relationships, clothes, cosmetics, but the truth of who we are, why we're here, and where we're going, is far more spectacular than any of these worldly things indicate. We are God's precious daughters, and we are always pregnant with His possibilities. This is not the kind of knowledge that sounds sane when divulged at a cocktail party, but in private, in meditation, in churches, mosques, and synagogues, at ashrams, and in support groups, it is the stuff of truth that sets us free. And women need desperately to be set free. We have been enslaved for centuries by our ignorance and our deep forgetfulness. It is time to remember we are the daughters of God. One of the themes of healing in the 90s is deeper spiritual practice. Now, when I say go talk to Mary, I mean go talk to Mary, as in go to a church, light a candle, sit in a pew, and let yourself become very serious about the whole thing. Tell her, Mary, I wish to know who I am, as a wife, or girlfriend, or mother, or daughter. I wish to be the woman I am capable of being. I wish to have your purity and clarity and level of enlightenment. May the essence of my womanhood become more radiant than my external self. And that's it. It doesn't matter what your religion is. Talking to Mary doesn't make you a Catholic, nor does being a Catholic give you some special in. And if Mary doesn't feel comfortable for you, that's okay too. Find a Greek goddess or a female Indian avatar you can relate to, or any other symbol of feminine divinity, and begin a relationship with her. Don't see this as a joke or treat it as a toy. The world as it is has very little use for your womanhood. You are considered a weaker sex and are treated as a sexual object. You are thoroughly dispensable except for bearing children. Your youth is the measure of your worth, and your age is the measure of your worthlessness. Do not look to the world for your sustenance or for your identity as a woman, because you will not find them there. The world despises you, but God adores you. I looked at a picture of my face today, and I hated the picture because it doesn't say who I am. But then most women's faces don't tell the truth, or I should say most women's hairdos don't tell the truth. Their clothes don't tell the truth. Their jewelry doesn't tell the truth. There are what appear to be magnificent exceptions. But far too often, when their adornments tell a great story, the women themselves don't. Most of us, most American women, are completely bewildered by our hair, clothes, and makeup. That's why we spend so much money on them. We're looking for help. The next time you meet another woman at a party, assume she experienced at least 10% as much angst over what to wear that night as you did. Multiply that angst by the number of women in America who went out to dinner that night. Now add up the stress. Feminine beauty is not a function of clothes or hair or makeup, although billions of dollars are spent in this country each year by women who have been convinced by the advertising industry that it is. Beauty is an internal light, a spiritual radiance that all women have, but most women hide, unconsciously denying its existence. And what we do not claim remains invisible, This is why the process of personal transformation, the true work of spiritual growth, whether couched in religious terms or not, is the only antidote to the pernicious effects of society's backlash against genuine female empowerment. Society programs us, through the subliminal messages of popular culture, to believe that we're not truly desirable as women unless we adhere to the current standards of physical beauty. But the reason we're such fertile ground for the dark forces of such lies and social manipulation is that we are dissociated from the genuine light of self-awareness. The woman who is truly self-aware knows that herself is a light from beyond this world, a spiritual essence that has nothing to do with the physical world. Those of us who strongly believe in the reality of spirit are quickly invalidated by a worldly power system that senses within spiritual truth the seeds of its own destruction. For if we truly believed in an internal light, we would not believe in the power of external forces, and we would not be so easy to dominate and control. We would not be tempted to see hair and clothes and makeup as sources of so much of our self-esteem and the ideal beauty of a fashion model as a sign that we're not beautiful at all. In the words of author Naomi Wolf, we as women are trained to see ourselves as cheap imitations of fashion photographs rather than seeing fashion photographs as cheap imitations of women. But we are ultimately responsible for how we see ourselves. Regardless of the horrible images of women, pornographic, misogynistic, and violent, that permeate our culture. Even much of traditional religious imagery has represented women as inferior, even evil. It is only an enlightened spiritual worldview that reveals both men and women in all our true glory. And we are glorious because we are not beings of this world at all. Our spiritual essence is non-material, non-physical, and when we become aware of this, we are genuinely empowered. The more we develop what is called in Alcoholics Anonymous our conscious contact with truth as God created it, the less we are prey to the lies of a fearful world. When we are truly aware of our spiritual glory, a varicose vein or two is not that big a deal. A woman once stood in line in front of me at a 7-Eleven. She was fat, at least 50 pounds overweight. Her hair was bleached blonde, and she was buying copies of The Globe and The National Enquirer, a bag of peanuts, and a huge prepackaged cookie. I felt her misery. I remember saying a little prayer for her. I have been as bummed out as she was, although I haven't acted out my despair in quite the same ways. But I have known, as we all have, her desire to escape into a world where she wouldn't have to face the harshness of another day like this one. At the same time, I know she cares desperately because we all do. Her body says she doesn't care. Her hair says she doesn't care, and her choice of reading material says she doesn't care, but she does care. And if she felt she had a choice, she would open up wide, act like a queen. But she doesn't realize she has the option. She thinks that only queens get to be queens. She doesn't know that every woman who is a queen simply knew she could be one, and that everyone else is still pretending she can't. And that's all that separates the queens from the slave girls, a shift in consciousness from denial to acceptance of personal power. Now, that woman's education may have been poor, and her family dysfunctional, and her present circumstances somewhere between horrible and catastrophic, but she remains a potential queen. A change in consciousness produces miracles. The growth of a woman from slave girl to queen is the miracle of feminine transformation. It begins with a decision to change and a willingness to accept God's help. If by any chance the woman I saw at the 7-Eleven is listening to this tape, say this prayer if you wish to. Dear God, I am willing to relinquish my life of limitation and despair. I invite your spirit to renew my life. Amen. It is God's will that we be beautiful, that we love and are loved, and prosper in all good things. It is God's will that we all be the goddesses we were created to be. Even when a woman has been blessed with great abundance, she often has a difficult time allowing herself to receive it all. I have a friend who has a wonderful life. She lives half the year in Europe and flies in her own private plane back and forth between her various houses around the world, and she has a husband who is perfect for her. She has a successful, fulfilling career in fashion design and two happy, healthy children. What she doesn't have is a thin waist. Now her suffering over her weight casts a giant shadow over a life that is otherwise so sweet. She has tried every diet, every doctor, every technique she could find to help herself lose the excess pounds and keep them off. What she had not tried until recently was confronting whatever it was in her that had so much invested in being fat. You see, there's no diet or doctor that can prevail against a strongly held belief. And in the case of my friend, and in the case of many people who carry around one thing, whatever it is, that blocks them from total joy, that belief is this. If I'm too happy, too successful, too perfect, I will not be loved. There has to be something that lets other people know that I'm really one of them, man. I'm miserable too. I'm really not taking away their piece of the pie. I'm really not perfect, so they don't have to hate me. For some women, it's weight. For others, it's something else we do or think or say to make it appear that we're having a hard time, too. We're unconsciously afraid of a reaction against us if we dare to shine fully, embrace joy, and permit ourselves to have too great a life. You see, the injunction against winning is subtle but strong, so we ourselves make sure that no one will be able to accuse us of having broken the great unspoken rule, do not experience heaven on earth. The punishment can be severe, at least emotionally, for those of us who break the rule. From friends to family to people who don't even know us, the chorus of disapproval can ring loudly against women who dare to break through the ultimate glass ceiling. What is the antidote to such threat? Whether it comes from others or in our own minds, it is to realize that it is God's will that each of us, every woman, man, and child, be happy, whole, and successful. It is impossible to overestimate the psychic damage done by the delusions, pseudo-religious and otherwise, that God is somehow happier or we are somewhat purer if we're suffering just a bit. The truth is not that God is happier or that we're better, but that the institutions that told us so are happier because suffering keeps us in our place where we are easier to control. But you tell me, how can there be a joyful planet without its being inhabited by joyful people? Our embracing joy does not rob others of the possibility. Quite the opposite is true. It liberates them, if they choose to be liberated. If I see before me a person who lives a truly happy life, I can follow my ego or follow my heart. My ego will try to argue that the person must be guilty of something, but my heart will recognize that his or her success is my success, if I can allow myself to applaud instead of criticize and bless instead of condemn. When I first began my career as a lecturer doing my best to make a positive difference in my community, I often heard people say, "Isn't she nice?" But as my work became visible to a larger public, the same work, done the same way, and with, if anything, even greater dedication, drew cries of, "Who does she think she is?" I have never received the criticism for failure that I have for success. And it is clear to me that people in our society, at least unconsciously, hold the conviction that someone else's success limits their own, makes them lesser, and puts a permanent lid on their own chances. You see, the world believes in finite resources and in everybody's guilt. As long as we adhere to these pernicious beliefs, we will not only fail to let others shine, but we will never be able to allow ourselves to shine fully either. And if we, like my friend, stand in fear of what fear says, in the minds of others or in our own minds, we then conspire in a thought system that cruelly limits us and our daughters and their daughters too. We refuse to allow ourselves to help the world as much as we might were we to allow ourselves to be all that we can be. God gives us abundance in all things that we might use it in behalf of the healing of the world. If we forge ahead and continue to embrace the life that God has opened up for us, then we will break through the cloud banks of other people's disapproval, whether real or imagined. When we ourselves no longer feel guilty, when we have liberated ourselves from the limited thinking of a society deeply afraid of ecstatic women, then we will no longer encounter people who attack us. Or if we do, we will no longer care. And having broken through the clouds, we will see a new light and meet new friends. Don't stop now. Keep going. The next time someone makes you feel as though, winning as you are, perhaps you're getting too big for your britches, say to them silently, "Oh, I haven't even started yet." We exist in God's mind as total and complete beings. There's nothing Madison Avenue can give us that will make us more beautiful women. We're beautiful because God created us that way. some of us know of our beauty and express it and celebrate it. But beauty itself is not given to us by anyone. It is a power we have within us from the gate, a radiance inside us. I've known women who were not physically beautiful, but who expressed themselves so magnificently that the result was a beautiful woman. I've known other women who were practically perfect physical specimens, but who were so unaware of their own light that the effect of their beauty was nil. So what should a woman do with a fractured sense of self? Well, many of us are good at describing and analyzing our insecurities, but what we must do now is invoke the healed self within each of us. In the realm of pure awareness is the goddess, the glorious female, the cosmic queen. Now, if you're a sensitive creature, and almost every woman is, then your heart is open to all things. Every cry we recognize, every tear we relate to, every sigh contains our own. But we're stymied by this, immobilized until we make a run in the other direction. A woman's emotional instrumentation, more delicate and intricate than any computer chip from Japan, is as fragile as it is powerful. It turns against us when it is not used for healing constructive purposes. It's as if God said, here, feel this. And we don't know whether he said that because he was angry at us or because he loves us. Without a potent inner life, a spiritual connection, a woman tosses on a storm of hysterical emotions. Like a beautiful vase into which the ocean is poured, shattering the glass because the container can't accommodate the force or the volume, we are ill-prepared for the beautiful and dynamic energies that race through our veins. We remember everything. We remember Mary holding the baby. We remember watching him die. We remember wars and murders we don't even know we remember. We remember ancient temple sites, our healings and our prophecies. We remember genital mutilation and Sophie's choice. We were present at the beginning of things, and if people would only let us, we would teach the marvelous lessons we learned from the experience. We can't get to our knowledge because the world is too loud. And we tend to make it louder as we cry out in pain, pretending we're singing. We add to the world's cacophony because we don't know it's our job to turn down the noise and listen to silent symphonies. No one told us that. For thousands of years, they haven't wanted us to know. But when we break free and see the game for what it is, we will let out a howl, and our silence will be deafening. We will hear the holy choir of angels. Our eyes will brighten, and our smiles will burst forth. The men around us so need this change, as much as we do, maybe more. Our children see in us the truth we do not see, that we have power unmatched by anyone else. When we remember our royal inheritance, men will become our true partners, our kings. We've all been crowned, and yet the throne awaits us. Now is the time to reclaim our title, to bow our heads before God and receive in awareness our conscious coronation. When we do, the world will change quickly. It will change when every woman gets it that we are all beautiful and powerful and strong, that we deserve love and approval and support, that we would all be glorious if we could only spread our wings, and that we are each one of us a portion of a great and mighty goddess self. What a light will arise from behind the mountains on the morning of our remembrance. What a sun will shine through the fog of tears when we embrace our true selves at last. Until we do, we will remain sad. Our imprisonment has been long and cruel. We have dressed to hide ourselves and spoken to misrepresent ourselves and worked to change ourselves. We have imagined our passions to be wrong and our instincts out of line. We have suffered a wounding, but a miracle has occurred. There is a woman in the sky, and she has come to take us home. The woman in the sky has long, beautiful hair and skin that glows. She smiles from a place deeper than the center of the earth. She has a beautiful speaking voice, and she can sing. She has mothered us all. We have inherited her gifts and her healing powers. In ancient agreement, we have come to this point to remember her together. Like a volcano erupting after years of stillness, we now explode with heat and power and liquid strength. The woman in the sky has entered into us. Like every aspect of the cosmic energy of which she is a part, she permeates the cells of those who have invited her in. She gives us new life that we might give it to others. Through her power within us, we redeem all things. For centuries, we've been ripped apart inside, our personalities disconnected from our most crucial knowledge. We have been concerned with small things when we ourselves are huge. But those days are over. We must begin again. We begin with a promise made to ourselves and to each other that we will never go back. We will never again fail to realize how hard it is for every woman, as it has been for us, to face the challenges and resistances of a world that treats women as second-class citizens. We have been relegated to such a position not because we are less intelligent. The world treats us as second-class citizens as a means of control, as if were we simply named weak, then we would be weak. And we have fallen for that ruse. We've been defeated by the power inherent in naming things. The spell that this power has cast on us must now be broken. We must name ourselves queens. Patriarchal power has resisted our strength, but the oppressive forces of an entire kingdom and the thought and treatment of women as inferior are a mental kingdom, have no power in the face of a woman who knows she is a queen. The negative ego fears women not because we are weak, but because we are so powerful and because our power comes from an invisible realm. The rational mind can neither explain it nor control it, and to the negative ego, this is unforgivable power. Still, we must claim our mystical forces. We must forge ahead through the dark and prickly forces of ridicule and resistance in whatever form they take, doing what we came here to do and being who we came here to be. Oppression of women is far from over, and often women themselves are the ones who make the world even harder for other women. But this phenomenon will fade away as female oppressing females become healed of their self-hatred. On the other side of this jungle is a new and glorious day on earth, wherein our daughters will not be judged wrong for their passions or held back because they are bursting with such power, strength, and love. Children help. Sunsets help. Good men help. The beach helps. Reading about women who have been great in their fields helps. Meditation helps. And prayer helps. There is a collective force rising up on the earth today, an energy of reborn feminine. She's peeking around corners, taking over businesses, tucking in the children, and making men go wild in every way. She knows us at our source. She is not, as we are not, lacking in virtue. She remembers our function on earth, that we should love one another. She has come to reclaim us. She has come to take us home. As the feminine spirit seeks to rise, there are numerous forces seeking to push her back down. This is a time of monumental shift from the male dominance of human consciousness back to a balanced relationship between masculine and feminine. The goddess archetype doesn't replace God, she merely keeps him company. She expresses his feminine face. But the resistance to this is stronger than most people know. The invalidation, the crucifixion of feminine power, is one of the most violent and subversive forces at work today. Time after time, the goddess has been beaten, thwarted, shut down, emotionally, physically, politically, and socially. Every time a woman is raped or beaten, every time a woman is attacked on the street or crucified in the press for no other reason than that she is a woman, every time a strong woman is squeezed out of the workplace because her presence there is too threatening to the old order, we are witnessing the skirmishes of a vast, invisible war. The fate of every woman alive today, whether she likes it or not, is that the story of her life shall be played out against this panorama. Her relationships with everyone and everything, from her parents to her teachers to her lovers to her children to her friends to her job to her employers to her employees to her community to her culture, have been, are, and will be affected by this gigantic conflagration. We have no choice whether or not this is happening. Our only choice is whether we shall open our eyes. When we remain ignorant of the forces swirling around us, we suffer the consequences of all unconsciousness, remaining at the effect of forces over which we seem to have no control. Should we awaken to the truth of the moment, we can consciously usher in one of the most important human breakthroughs in history. We have the opportunity to forge a marriage between masculine and feminine more potent and more vibrant than any we have experienced on earth for ages, more beautiful perhaps than the earth has ever known. The story doesn't begin with grown women being massacred in the workplace or in the press. It begins with innocent little girls who become convinced, for whatever reason, that the girl within them isn't good enough. From there, they turn into women who are always seeking to deny their femininity, and from there, they attract others who will want to do the same. In order to dismantle a social disorder in which women are oppressed, we must begin where it all started. a long, long time ago, when we were very, very young. Now, many of us grew up in dysfunctional families because modern society is a dysfunctional place. But the spiritual journey, the path of recovery and personal growth, is a detoxification process in which we bring up and out the negative beliefs that we have carried with us from the past and that now poison the present. We then learn to invoke the flame within us, which did not go out during our dark and difficult years. However confused we might have become, angels protected us and shielded us. Our spirits did not die. There is an ever-renewable, natural strength within us that still exists and is accessible now. Regardless of what Mommy did or didn't do, how Daddy loved us or ignored us, or whether we feel we've succeeded or failed at life so far. I call that innocent place within every woman the lost girl. I could have been a mystical princess. I should have been a mystical princess. I was supposed to be a mystical princess. This is the cry of the woman who has tried to reclaim her lost girl. The lost girl is still within us. The girl who wasn't allowed to blossom. The girl whose natural childhood instincts were unnaturally capped at puberty. The girl who was squelched in fear of the woman she would become. For years, we lived damaged, cut off from the true expression of who we are, because we don't know who we are. We are numb to our own creative juices. No one held a space for our gorgeousness, and now we can't find it. As maidens, we were crushed. We were treated with suspicious looks at the very moment someone should have been turning up the applause. We don't know how to be women, because we were taught it was not okay to be girls. Our most natural impulses were thwarted and distorted. We were like lava channeled into plastic molds. Recently, I met a woman in her early 20s who was deeply depressed, and looking at her, I saw myself 15 or 20 years ago. I recognized every desperate feeling, every horrified thought, and I asked her why she felt so sad. Well, she told me she felt misunderstood by her father, who didn't want to pay for her therapy or for her move to another city. She said she was trying to make a way in the world but kept falling down. She couldn't stay with any career very long. She felt fat, she felt inadequate, she felt embarrassed, and kept thinking that other people were laughing at her. The reality in this instance is that of an exquisitely beautiful young woman, as fat as the Pope is Jewish and as lacking in brains as Susan Sontag, but here is a girl who doesn't know how to find her glory. But that's what our 20s are for, I told her. They're the time when the maiden turns into a woman. The princess becomes a queen, the child grows up. They are not the time to concentrate on our parents so much as they are the time to concentrate on ourselves and our own abilities. You see, her father's money came with a very high price tag, as it usually does. What she wanted in a protector was not to be found in Daddy, but in God. The peace and security she was looking for could only be found within herself, through a search for a higher, more noble life and an embrace of the glory within her. I told her that a career grows out of who we are doesn't grow out of a career. Her goal must not be to find a job, but to become a magnificent woman. That is the mystical calling of every woman's heart, and it is our core task in growing up. Later on in life, we're often bound by things, by responsibilities, by people, by situations that keep us tied to certain spaces and times. But a young woman must fly free, away from Mommy and Daddy. Away from the dense conventions of the world, away from childhood, and into the arms of the goddess who awaits her. A hysterical depression can then become a magnificent adventure. And when I myself was about her age, I worked for a man who was and still is a master at logos. His intellect is staggering. At the time I knew him, I was a maiden, a young woman like my friend, whose thoughts were scattered like wind through a half-built house. I knew many things that I could not yet articulate. I felt different from others, unable to play the parts assigned to me by the world in which I lived. As for the man, I knew he couldn't see me. But still, I felt that one day my life would turn out fine, and I knew he would be surprised when it did. Now, everything he spoke of was factual. Everything could be measured and proved by the scientific mind. I, with my feelings bruised and scorched, knew that the lessons I was learning were not from the intellect, but from the trials of my heart. And I knew that these lessons had more to do with where the world was going than did any of his facts or figures. The heart would be the language of tomorrow, because the heart is where our pain is. So recently I read that he said of me, quote, "She was the last person in the world you would have ever expected to be a success," unquote. Now I laughed when I read that, and I understood his thinking. You see, the feminine way seems weak to the masculine prejudice. And when I worked for him, I was a developing feminine spirit, lots of tears, lots of drama. For thousands of years, the woman's way, our way, has been kept underground. Unlike Mary, we are not prepared for our role. No gracious institutionalized structure is unrolled like a red carpet to usher us onto earth. so we come into the world covered in mess from our rocky ascent. But now the goddess is returning. She is making her way up, and people without eyes to see will be completely in the dark about the journey of women all around them. As the goddess begins to make her claim on them, there will be more rather than fewer girls who appear to make no sense. The goddess makes a dramatic entry. When a system is flooded with new and radical impressions, it seems to implode before making a quantum leap forward into something different. Thus, there are millions of girls who are depressed to a degree beyond what their families and friends find normal, but who are actually undergoing the feminine journey into full and actualized consciousness. One day, they will be queens, and the transition wouldn't have happened had they not cracked up when they did. The princess does become a woman if she stays the road. It is as if there were a beautiful enchantress in a luminous bubble. She stands before us and beckons for us to become her. Faith in her invokes our best. We change. We become unlike who we used to be. It is the miracle we sensed when we were little girls, that one day we would live lives of joy in enchanted castles. Let us seek all that is true and loving and good about womanhood and ask for the blessings thereof, for ourselves and for others. We ask that our womanhood bless our communities, our families, our friends. We ask for wisdom and guidance that we might reach the highest vibration of humanity of which we are capable. We look to God and his many teachers, to the goddess and her many faces, to show us what we do not know. From here we can grow more each passing day into the women God would have us be. There is no higher prayer. From there we shall know joy, and joy is what we were born for. It is our goal, our destiny. We cannot know who we are except in joy. Not knowing joy, we do not know ourselves. When we are without joy, we grope in the dark. When we are centered in joy, we attain our wisdom. A joyful woman, by merely being, says it all. See, the world is terrified of joyful women. Make a stand. Be one anyway. Joy is what happens when we allow ourselves to recognize how good things are. Joy is not necessarily what happens when things unfold according to our own plans. How often that's happened. We married the right man, had the children, got the job, but we've still known despair. Joy is what happens when we see that God's plan is perfect. We're already soaring in a perfect show. It demands that we have the audacity to embrace the knowledge of just how beautiful we really are and how infinitely powerful we are right now without changing a thing through the grace that's consistently born and reborn within us. Such an embrace is not arrogant, but humble. It is not crazy, but realistic. It is an appraisal of our lives through the eyes the goddess gives us. I've not known a lot of joy, but I've known some. When I am there, in that golden circle where everything feels wonderful for no apparent reason, I try to memorize the feeling, the terrain, the scenery. I've noticed how full I feel at those moments, with an overwhelming sense of rightness about all things. I know that this is our natural state and that the purpose of our lives is to achieve it consistently. For now, joy is a gift, an act of grace that's here when it's here and not when it's not. But perhaps joy can be practiced. Perhaps we can decide to be happy, to give joy before waiting to receive it. This is not denial, but affirmation of the power we have inside us. Embracing joy heals depression. Then we become the ones who teach the meaning of joy to our children, as well as allowing them to teach it to us. We bring joy to one another, to men, to children, and to God. Just knowing we're meant to do this increases its presence within us. Our deciding to be joyful demonstrates our willingness to relinquish the petty and negative preoccupations that stand in its way. When we give these up, a more joyful life has a chance to emerge. I think women can have it all, but not immediately. The various forces of our power take years to fully develop. One of the ideas we must agree on and continue to forge with individual and collective vigor is that a woman's life goes uphill at 40. The French say that a woman blossoms at 40, but in America we're still burdened by our abhorrence of age, particularly in women. I remember when I was younger and looked great in a way that only the young can look, but I'm also sure that in those days I had no clue as to what makes a woman glorious. Some young women do, I realize. They know much more than I did. But women my age and older, who didn't know until now, should continue to blossom as long as we're breathing. For me and for many other women 40 and over, the pieces of the puzzle have only just begun to fit together. What mature women want is this: the lightheartedness of our youth with the added depth our suffering of the last few years has given us. Through the grace of the goddess, it is within our grasp to have both. Genuine spiritual experience transforms our suffering into something beautiful and lifts the heavy burden from our hearts. The older we get, the lighter we can become. It takes effort to move in this direction because it is counter to the ways of the world, but running counter to the ways of the world is the purpose of our lives. The enlightened system isn't set up so that we work hard, finally find joy, experience it for a relatively short time, and then grow old and die. Unless we strive for an expanded, more compassionate vision of age and aging, the achievements we seek here are at best cruel mockeries of our pain-filled efforts. Let us imagine a woman's life improving as she ages. Age doesn't have to be bad. It could, in fact, be magnificent if we would take our spiritual lives more seriously. Throughout our 20s and 30s, we care so much about what the Joneses think, even if we think we don't. These two decades are the time when we're most tempted to try to live for others. Around 40, it occurs to us that the Joneses are either going to like us or they're not, that the Joneses have holes in their socks too, thank you, and that we have less control over what other people think than we ever imagined. Other people shouldn't have so much control over what we think anyway. There's too much you should not told to women these days. Whether a woman takes hormones, wants a facelift, wants to admit her age, or wants to talk about menopause is nobody's business but her own. There's privacy in a woman's heart that should never be violated, and certainly not in the name of feminism. We are doing the best we can. Whatever we came up with on our journey to expanded consciousness, let us have and let us be. What's going on inside us matters. Everything else is cosmetic and should be treated as such. Once we remember we're cosmic queens, these issues won't arise. That's the only solution to all our shallow traumas. We can stop trying so hard to win love and power and influence because on some days we'll have those things and on others we won't. But if we look to them for sustenance, we will find despair. And growing more desperate, we will grow old. Age appalls us because maturity appalls us, responsibility appalls us. Our 30s are the time to get serious about being an adult, taking responsibility for our communities and our families. Our 40s become the time for getting good at those things, for achieving some mastery. And in our 50s, we should be able to shine. People in their 50s are like full-bodied wine. In our 60s and 70s, we could, in addition to shining, start teaching others, those coming up after us, how to do what we've done. Without a spiritual life, what are we left with? What is there to strive for? Where do we look for clues? In magazines? Here are some basics for spiritual renewal. First of all, meditate. Do transcendental meditation, that's my favorite, or Christian meditation, Jewish meditation, Buddhist meditation, open-eye meditation, full moon meditation, Quaker meditation, it doesn't matter, just do it. Also, pray. Engage in some sort of daily spiritual practice. It could be non-religious, religious, or whatever. Above all else, try to forgive. And lastly, treat your body well. Practice yoga or some equivalent form of concentrated physical exercise. Do not look to your husband, your lover, your children, your job, your money, or your therapist to make you happy. It's not their function to do that, nor within their capacity to do so. Look within yourself, to the goddess within you, and take responsibility for your own state of mind. Choose an affirmation that fits you, your hopes and your desires. Try to stay away from specifics and concentrate instead on the woman you want to be. You could say, I am a glorious child of God. I am joyful, serene, positive, and loving. Write it on several pieces of paper. Pin them up in your house or tape them to the dashboard of your car. The mind is more powerful than any external condition. If you repeat your affirmation 10 times a day, particularly in combination with meditation, your life will change. Spiritual techniques cannot not work. The question is not whether they work, but whether we actually do them. If we remind ourselves often of the woman we want to be, then the woman who has been masquerading as us all these years will breathe her last breath and give us back our life. On the days when I do these things, and having turned 40 myself, I've finally learned how important it is to do them all, I feel good. On the days when I don't do them, I don't feel as well. And I must admit that there are often days during the month when nothing makes me happy and that's it, because PMS is PMS. Chemical depression, of course, is an even harder nut to crack. There are times and conditions when, despite our exercises, we continue to cry and we continue to feel pain. I'm talking here about the broad strokes, the vast majority of our days. Try those things. Meditation, prayer, yoga, affirmations, and the fabric of your life will become more beautiful and peaceful. At times, we can find sustenance in a spiritual retreat, a woman's retreat, a vacation, a time off. It's important to have the chance to get away from it all. But we must remember that the serenity and peace a retreat provides should not be limited to our time away from home. We must commit ourselves to incorporating the conditions that foster peace and serenity into our daily lives. So much inside us can flourish when we turn off the worldly noise. You see, the search for inner peace is a lifestyle decision. Even when we have children, they can learn that at certain hours, Mommy needs quiet time. As much as we crave the rest a vacation offers, we often resist it. Many of us have set up our lives so that we're constantly busy, living on a kind of adrenaline that poses as energy. But this is actually an insidious trick of the negative mind, building a wall of frantic activity that mitigates against the experience of a meaningful inner life. And we lose a tremendous amount of personal power and healthy energy by allowing ourselves to be lured away from daily spiritual practice. The spiritual life is our inner life, and a woman is lost without her connection to God and Goddess within her. As for physical appearance, as we age, gorgeous young hunks may or may not be interested in us anymore. For that matter, men our own age and older might not be interested in us anymore. And my response to that is, so what? We could have met up with these same guys when we were young, and they would still have been turned off to us anyway once we got older. But have faith in men. There is a new breed forming, just as we are a new breed of women. They're quite young, some of them, and they're older also. They're learning. They're growing, and they're everywhere. Hold on. Just take care of yourself. Strive to live a more loving, more beautiful life. They won't not find you. Your appeal is huge and invisible and real. What now? Agreements. Agreements that we will not hurt one another, that we will support one another. We will protect the children and heal the earth. We will make love and art, and we will love like artists. A woman is meant to hold the heart of the world within her hands. She must cater to it and minister to it and kiss it when it cries. Women are meant to keep the home fires burning, the fires in our hearts. Women are meant to prepare the food, the spiritual food of love and compassion. We are meant to care for the children, not just our own, but every child. When we do not recognize our cosmic function, our own hearts break, and so does the heart of the world. Just as children grow by playing games in which they imagine themselves to be grown-ups, so are we meant to grow by imagining ourselves to be bigger than we are right now. You need not apologize for being brilliant, talented, gorgeous, rich, or smart. Your success doesn't take away from anyone else's. It actually increases the possibility that others can have it also. Your money increases your capacity to give money to others. Your joy increases your capacity to share joy with others. And your love increases your capacity to give love to others. Your playing small serves no one. It is a sick game. It is old thinking, and it is dire for the planet. Stop it immediately. Come home to the castle. As author Emma Goldman wrote, a true conception of the relation between the sexes will not admit of conqueror and conquered. It knows but of one great thing, to give of oneself boundlessly in order to find oneself richer, deeper, better. The story of many modern relationships is a variation on a common theme, the conspiracy between men and women to murder the goddess. Whenever a woman sells herself cheap, or a man is unkind to a woman, or a woman gives her body where she is not adored, or a man rejects his true love, we are trying to murder the goddess. But the goddess cannot die. She can be tortured, but she cannot die. A friend recently spoke to me of a very powerful man on the East Coast who has gained a reputation for toying cruelly with the hearts of so-called powerful women. The question, of course, is how does a powerful woman allow herself to be toyed with? What place of wounded self-esteem makes her vulnerable to his emotionally sadistic machinations? Thousands of us have been in therapy, taken seminars, read extensively, and explored all other means to personal growth in the last several years in order to learn how to avoid those guys. We've prayed, we've been on our knees, so where were these women? You know, go into therapy, go to a good bookstore. The buzzwords now are recovery, wellness, bringing back joy. There's a great story about recovering from attraction to dangerous men. It goes like this. So when you're really ill, you don't even know a snake when you see one. Once recovery begins, you see a snake, you know it's a snake, but you still play with it. Once you've landed in true recovery zone, you see a snake, you know it's a snake, and you cross to the other side of the road. But until then, everyone you know can tell you the game is toxic with that person, but you won't listen because you think you're different, or that he'll be different with you, or that maybe you're the first one to have really seen a sensitive side. There's no forcing the process by which we simply stop being attracted to pain. It's a long road for some of us. It's work. It takes deeper thinking and more courage than many of us are used to. But it's going on everywhere. It's the real liberation. And there aren't a lot of excuses in today's world for not joining in the work that will ultimately free us all. There's not much mystery here. Sickness is not that interesting. When you were a little girl, Daddy told you in various ways that you weren't really all that great, so that any man who gives you the same message years later feels to you like the one you belong with. He's familiar, you see, in that he's remote and slightly disapproving. And the more we look, the more we realize it wasn't just Daddy who went weird on us around the time we reached puberty. The whole world did. Our burgeoning sexuality didn't just freak out Daddy, who was attracted and repelled at the same time. It freaked out Mommy, too, who was jealous, and our teachers, who had similar projections. It freaked out the entire society in which we grew up, because sex is still thought of as evil here. As we grew more and more into our womanhood, we were perceived as being more and more dangerous. See, none of this was conscious on anyone's part. Very little is conscious in this society or anywhere. The whole human race is still basically in a fog, but that's why we're here. And it's definitely why we're looking into this painful stuff that's been ruling us subconsciously for ages. Women are very confused about power, and actually so are men. Feminine power isn't something we go out and acquire. It's already within us. Rather, it's something we become willing to experience. It's something to possess, something to admit we have. Until we do, our positive power lies unexpressed. It's there, but it's not working. We're wired for something we don't know how to access. Having been taught that the power of strong women is in various ways suspect, many of us find it hard to fully embrace our power. We're afraid. But the goddess is ready to correct our thinking. Her key, the access point, the miracle, is love. We are here only to love, and love casts out fear. And when we understand that love is the reason for our power, that love is our power, we lose our fear of owning its strength. We become willing to experience the power within us, that it might be used as a channel through which love is expressed to all humankind. And so, powerful women fall prey to the East Coast lady killer, not because he's consciously seeking to murder the goddess, but because they are. Not having embraced her themselves, they find no one else to embrace her either. They're stuck in a princess mode, crying, tearing their hair out, shouting, "You can't treat me this way," when quite obviously he sure can. Until we own our own power, we will constantly seek it in others, particularly in men, and power thought that way never saves us, it destroys us. Many women complain that they keep attracting the wrong relationship. What they mean by that, of course, is that they are attracted to the wrong relationship. They are stuck in a place that is dangerous but seductive. They want desperately to get out of the pattern, but often not quite desperately enough. They lack the self-esteem to save their own lives. We give up what we want to give up, and keep what in some ways we still want to keep. There are payoffs for holding on to small, weak patterns. We have an excuse not to shine. We don't have to take responsibility for the world when we're spending all our time in emotional pain. We're too busy. The truth that sets us free, as always, is an embrace of the divine within us. It means remembering we are the daughters of God, and the daughters of God don't break for jerks. When a woman falls in love with the magnificent possibilities within herself, the forces that would limit those possibilities hold less and less sway over her. A relationship that keeps us tied to the push and pull of codependent neuroses is a block to our shining. When we're very clear we want to shine, and if we want to know the goddess, we want to shine, then we attract into our lives the kinds of relationships that help us do that. Until a woman has given herself permission to be fabulous, she will not find herself with partners who promote her ability to be so. As long as she tears herself down, she'll attract people who tear her down. She will find others who agree that she's undeserving and lacking, as long as that's how she thinks of herself. So we are left with a commitment to being a certain kind of woman before worrying about finding a certain kind of man. Once we make such a commitment, good guys will appear. Until we do, let's just say they're waiting in the lobby. Embrace the goddess and her divine perception of you. Ask her to reveal to you the you she has in mind. Ask her to send you the relationships and circumstances that will foster that strength within you, that the world might be blessed by the presence of a woman in all her glory. Ask, and you will receive. Don't ask, and you will continue to receive the relationships that destroy you. Until we embrace the light, we remain vulnerable to darkness. The choice is easy once we see it for what it is. In relationships, as in everything else, we ask for heaven or we ask for hell. Several years ago, my boyfriend left me for a bimbo. Actually, he didn't leave me, and according to quite a few people, she's not a bimbo. But my emotional experience, as arrogant and unenlightened as it was that I had been rejected for someone half my size. It's not uncommon for an intelligent man to gravitate toward a woman who can't quite put a sentence together. Why does it happen? I wanted to find out because the pain I felt was searing. I knew in my heart that I had blown something big time, and I wanted to correct myself. I would have done anything and gone anywhere to learn what I needed to before I went out again. Some of the clearest thinking we do about relationships occurs while we're not in one. We're humbler and more in touch with our pain, and therefore more teachable. Our intelligence is always sharper when informed by our own feelings. At another point in my life, I lived a scene like the one at the end of Gone with the Wind, where Scarlett asks Rhett what's to become of her if he leaves her. In my case, the man did give a damn, but he still had to leave. I then had to prove to myself and to whomever else I thought might care that I could make it without him. Imagine another scene, the one in which Scarlett says, "I will never go hungry again." My pledge, uttered with the same strength and anguish, was, "I will never need a man again." That was a flawed decision. I couldn't have him, so I became him. I wanted him within me so badly. I invoked his energy from within myself. I conquered outer worlds, just as he had. I expressed masculine strength and power, just as he had. But it didn't bring me closer to him or to others like him, because I had become one of the guys. And that's not what most men are looking for. He had never loved me for being a great guy. I don't know when my mourning set in, but I know it climaxed when I lost out to the woman I thought was a bimbo. What I realized was that she was in some ways the old me, not the me I wanted to become, but the me I had been and then left behind. She wasn't stupid. I just wanted to think she was. And that's why I had to hate her. I couldn't bear to take on all the hatred I felt toward myself for becoming so masculine and tough. So I started to understand what had gone wrong, including the realization that I was far from alone in my predicament. And it wasn't just enough to understand. I had to retrain myself, which actually I'm still doing. I don't want to lose the masculine power I've developed, the worldly effectiveness, the power to act on things I care about. It's part of me, and an important aspect of who we all are. It has certainly been a necessary social development for women to actualize their masculine power in the world. But I needed to put things in their proper perspective. In intimate relationships with men, I want to major in feminine and minor in masculine. At a lecture podium, I'm the masculine active energy to the audience's feminine receptiveness. But after work, if I'm with a man I'm close to, I want to experience myself as a woman. And I no longer kid myself that it would work for him or for me to play it any differently. And that doesn't mean we don't trade roles at times. It just means that the dominant groove is that he's masculine and I'm feminine. The masculine is active, the feminine passive. The masculine is dynamic, the feminine magnetic. The masculine does while the feminine is. Part of our Amazon neurosis is the way we've all learned to play the man, to go to get him before he comes to us, to call first, to make the first move. And only now do we realize what a mistake that is, and we're having to tie our hands behind our backs, bite our tongues, sit on our credit cards. Most of us want a masculine man, but there's no way to have one unless we become feminine women. At first, we're like outraged to realize this, because we thought we were being such good girls developing our masculine side to begin with. That's what we thought real worth, real power was. We came to see women, usually beginning with mommy, as weak and ineffective, so we wanted to grow up and be just like daddy. And God help us, we did. When I was growing up, my father was a well-known immigration lawyer and my mother a housewife. My father was given constant kudos for his admirable contributions to the lives of poor and struggling immigrants. My mother, as far as I was concerned, did not participate meaningfully in the world at all, because at the time, I could not see that driving kids to ballet class, scheduling Girl Scout meetings, or sewing doll clothes was important work. Today, I see things very differently. I see I was one of thousands of young girls who unconsciously decided that our mother's lives were meaningless while our father's lives were glamorous and important. So the way it succeeded, it seemed to me, was to grow up and be just like Daddy. When I started lecturing on A Course in Miracles in the early 80s, I found myself surrounded by people burdened with serious problems. I met many people with HIV-positive infections and other life-challenging illnesses. I was thrown into a world in which other people were hurting more than I was, and the moral as well as professional imperative was that I be the strong one and hold other people up. Unconsciously, I had created a career just like Daddy's. I had become what in Jungian terms is called a father's daughter. I learned early on to apply discipline to my professional endeavors. Week after week, month after month, year after year, I showed up at prayer groups, lectures, support groups, hospital rooms, marriages, funerals. I founded organizations, had a child, wrote a book. I knew I had to be strong, and I thought strength didn't cry. I had seen my father's lack of emotion as strength and my mother's show of emotion as weakness. I wanted to be strong like my father. I couldn't break down at the funeral if I was the one conducting the service. If a mother was grieving for her son, I couldn't cave in. I wanted to be a shoulder for her to lean on. I didn't want to do anything that would threaten my ability to be strong in my role of mother hen. What I didn't understand was that I'd become not a mother hen, but a father hen. Although I was driven by tender emotions, I thought that expressing them fully might limit my power. So I built a wall that would hold my emotions at bay, thinking I needed to do that in order to best serve others. It took a lot of willpower to build that wall, but I can see now that it didn't take strength. The denial of emotion, through suppression or withdrawal, is a weak move, not a courageous one. So this is the Amazon neurosis, the woman who achieves at the expense of her tender places. From the time she was a little girl, she was slowly but surely led to believe that her emotions were less important than her achievements, perhaps even antithetical to them. And the love she received in response to her achievements, if it was love at all, is not the love that warms the night. A woman who cannot honor her own feelings will not find them honored by anyone else. Other people will find her hard to penetrate. I've experienced this in diverse and painful ways. When I began to realize what a high personal price I paid for dissociating myself from my own feelings, I did what I had to do to let them up and out. Lots of therapy, lots of work, lots of pain. And then, sure enough, just as I'd feared, I began to lose my grip. I conducted a funeral service for someone I had hardly known, and I couldn't stop crying as I gave my talk. But this was just a temporary phase. I moved on through the weepy period, and I came out at the other end stronger and more tender, less guarded and more available. Usually, when we think of power, we think of external power, and we think of powerful people as those who have made it in the world. A powerful woman isn't necessarily someone who has money, but we think of her as someone with a boldness or a spark that makes her manifest in a dramatic way. When we think of a powerful man, we think of his ability to manifest abundance, usually money, in the world. Most people say that a powerful woman does best with a powerful man, that she needs someone who understands the bigness of her situation, a man who can meet her on the same or even greater level of power in the world. Now, this is true if power is defined as material abundance. A woman often faces cultural prejudice when she makes more money than a man, as does he. A woman who defines power by worldly standards can rarely feel totally relaxed in the arms of a man who doesn't have it. If power is seen as an internal matter, then the situation changes drastically. Internal power has less to do with money and worldly position and more to do with emotional expansiveness, spirituality, and conscious living. As we begin to recognize that internal strength is all that really matters, we come to see that we have often avoided men who were not powerful in the world, not because they were not powerful enough, but because inwardly they were too powerful, reminding us of the work we still had to do on ourselves. I used to think that I needed a powerful man, someone who could protect me from the harshness and evils of the world. What I have come to realize is that the evils of the world that confront me are a reflection of my own internal state, and no one can protect me from my own mind. The powerful man I was looking for would be foremost someone who supported me in keeping myself on track spiritually, and in so maintaining clarity within myself that life would pose fewer problems. When it did get rough, he would help me forgive. I no longer want someone who would say to me, "Don't worry, honey, if they're mean to you, I'll beat them up or buy them out." Instead, I want someone who prays and meditates with me regularly, so that fewer monsters from the outer world disturb me, and who, when they do, helps me look within my own consciousness for answers, instead of looking to false power to combat false power. There's a big difference between a gentle man and a weak man. Weak men make us nervous. Gentle men make us calm. Many of us have desired or do desire marriage. How much of our desire is natural and how much of it is cultural? What is natural is our desire for the beloved. What is cultural is our tendency to forget that a piece of paper cannot tie hearts together. The issue is not whether we marry, but whether we allow any choice of lifestyle to impinge on our ability to fly. What is important, if we do choose to marry, is that we not give up our wilder spirits. I once heard someone say, "Married women can't ride." I don't think this is true, but I understand what it means. Marriage is not a mere convention, but it is often lived as one, and as such, will sink instead of uplift a woman's spirit. The creative spirit thrives on freedom and daring. Many of history's most creative women have not been married. As for the priestesses of olden times, don't even think about it. Priestesses were spiritual mermaids, and a lot of men were drowning. Patriarchal culture senses danger in the unmarried woman. If a man is unmarried, he's called a bachelor. If a woman is unmarried, she's called a spinster or an old maid. What is it about an unmarried woman that poses such a threat to the patriarchal order? Mainly, it is that women are no one's property when we're unmarried. We're under no one's control, and neither are our children. There is no telling what we might say or do. Much of the prejudice against women is stored at an unconscious level. Many of those who hold the most punishing attitudes towards passionate women, and free women are passionate women, consider themselves social liberals, even feminists. Women's rights seem to them to be of obvious importance, but what is not obvious to them is how much they conspire to keep the lid on female power. Female power transcends what are known politically as women's issues. Female power has to do with women taking an active part in the conversation, whether in the public arena or at the dinner table, and having the same emotional space in which to do so as men. It means women not having to fear punishment of any kind. It means women not having to worry that they'll be considered unfeminine if they speak up. It means women really coming out to play and getting support for their playing from men as well as from women. Until this is accomplished, political, economic, and reproductive freedom will still not be enough. We will not be free until we can speak our minds and our hearts without having to worry that men will crucify us, women will crucify us, the press will crucify us, or our children will be ashamed. The true politics of women's liberation is human politics. It is under the surface, the energy in a room, not in the bedroom, because there we won freedom as soon as it was discovered how much more fun life is when we're in the game. But outside the bedroom, we're still not equal partners, and until we are, the world will not be healed. Women are still in emotional bondage as long as we need to worry that we might have to make a choice between being heard and being loved. After the Anita Hill-Clarence Thomas showdown on Capitol Hill, a friend told me an interesting story. She had watched the televised hearings with several married couples, and except for herself and one other, the women in attendance remained silent. But their husbands, on the other hand, held forth on how shameful it all was, expressing their perfect liberal views with seemingly no awareness of what was going on in that very room. Their wives behaved like good little girls, sitting by quietly, allowing their husbands to sound brilliant and insightful. Now, would things have been different had the couples not been married? I don't know. What is operative in this case is not marriage, but the connection between men and women itself. What needs to be addressed is who we are in partnership. Whether we're married matters less and less as the definition changes along with everything else around us. What I think is relevant in this story is not that the couples were married, but that they were in public. Behind closed doors, perhaps each of these husbands shows great respect for his wife. What is still lacking in American society is permission for women to speak out in public, loudly, clearly, without being considered ball breakers. Let's look at that name one more time, ball breaker. Now, try to come up with an expression that conjures more of an association with male pain. It's almost impossible. Now try to come up with an expression more frequently associated with a woman who speaks her mind. Most women, faced with the choice of hurting men or shutting up, go back to sleep and sleep forever. Women and men are now obviously relearning our roles vis-a-vis one another, both in marriage and out of it. Several years ago, I was leading a weekend seminar when the subject of marriage came up. So I asked how many people in the group were married, and then I asked them to express their thoughts about it. As the group of 30 or so talked late into the night, I heard things that surprised me, and I realized that weekend, and became more and more aware during subsequent sessions of counseling married as well as unmarried couples that marriage is whatever people make of it, and detrimental to all of us who hold narrow, formulaic pictures of what that should be. I've heard married couples who describe their conjugal relationships as very, very happy in monogamous as well as in open marriages. I've heard married couples who describe their conjugal relationships as boring and unhappy in monogamous as well as in open marriages. Sex is a sacrament, not a prison. While monogamy can be a beautiful, even sacred bond, it might not be the agreement that best suits everyone. Our thinking that monogamy is inherently a nobler arrangement than any other has created a nation of hypocrites, which is what we have become.